This is Geekspeak with Lyle Truxell. This is a show exploring the intersection of humanity and technology, coming from the fringes of Silicon Valley. Today's title: Amazon goes with bosses after Australian meltdown.
My name is Lyle Troxell, and in the air with me is Mr. Miles Elam. He's a software engineer, father, political junkie, a bit of a farmer. Hi, Miles. Welcome to joining me.
How's it going?
Quite well, thank you. Have you heard of Snap Inc., the makers of cameras?
As a matter of fact, I haven't.
Snap Inc. is a camera company. We believe that reinventing the camera represents our greatest opportunity to improve the way people live and communicate. The thing I love about it and why they're on the news is that recently the chief legal counsel threatened harsh punishment for employees that leaked company information. Of course it was leaked, the memo. If you leak Snap Inc. information, you will lose your job and we will pursue any and all legal remedies against you, the memo read in part, and that's just the start. You can face personal financial liability even if you yourself did not benefit from the leaked information. In any case, sounds like a pretty, pretty controlling of their staff. So Snap Inc., bummer, not a place to work, in my opinion, from this one news story with no information.
Okay.
And, you know, I don't want to just be negative. In my opinion, the way to make sure that you have a community of people working for you that actually think and engage in what they're doing is give them a lot of freedom and a lot of responsibility to make good decisions. And you get good people. That's where people want to work. For further information on this, you can go see an episode with myself and another employee at Netflix called Working at Netflix. I'll link to it in the show notes. Today's show, of course, is the January 26th episode of Geekspeak for the 18th season. And Miles, you're just saying that we've been doing this so long that now we're the old crusty dudes doing
it. Yep.
Because when we started on the radio, we were the youngins. And now we're not, after 18 years.
Yep. Basically.
It's kind of depressing.
We were talking earlier about some old stuff, but we were getting into how you go to the doctor and it's just like, oh, man, it hurts. Like the doctor just says, yep.
Yeah, you take your computer to somebody that's fixing computers. Like, this problem is that. Oh, well, we got to do this. We can do this. We can do that. You could change this out and all that. But your doctor, your eye doctor, your dentist, all that. Yeah, that's just going to be like that now.
Oh, your tear duct's not working anymore. Well, here's some drops. How long do you have to take the drops? You don't stop. You just keep taking the drops.
Hopefully a long time, because you can stop when you die. Old and busted. So NVIDIA suggests a solution to their current problem. What is NVIDIA's problem right now?
The problem is that a lot of people want to buy their top high-end cards for gaming.
Because it's kind of like the de facto awesome card for gaming.
Right. Yeah. It was amazing, really, because you had all the graphics that show up on computers. A lot of them were driven by gamers always pushing for, you know, faster frame rates and higher resolutions. But now the gamers can't get their hands on the cards anymore.
Why?
Because cryptocurrencies.
Because everybody's doing cryptocurrency.
Right. And they're not just buying a card or two. They're going, how many do you have? Buy all of them. Right. So then when a gamer comes in and they just want to buy one or two, you know, there's none on the shelves. They have to go to the second or third tier.
Right.
And so NVIDIA is asking retailers to only let shoppers buy two at once, like the maximum, you know, two per customer type of thing, just so that more people can get access to them.
Why doesn't NVIDIA just bake more of them?
There is always a limit to how much they can output.
Sure.
So they're trying. I mean, they want more people to buy them, but they're at capacity. They're trying to get silicon out as quickly as possible. But it's giving them a bad name. Like, so if people start always going for the NVIDIA ones, then maybe they'll go for the AMD. If they can't get that, or you know, there's a sense of fair play. I mean, there's a global warming argument too. The fact that we're expending so much power to mine this currency that the price of the coin that you're getting out of it doesn't make up for the amount of electricity that you're using to mine it.
Right. And actually, mining is highly successful in areas where electricity is very cheap because of giant investments. So there's areas in China where electricity is almost free, and therefore throwing a whole bunch of hardware at it and mining.
And throwing a whole bunch of coal in the furnace. Yeah,
yeah, or they're doing dams and other sources of electricity too. But yeah, it's completely a broken system from that perspective, specifically Bitcoin. I'm not sure about all the currencies, if all the cryptocurrencies have the same kind of problem. I think some are set up a little bit more intelligently. But we will have a future show all on cryptocurrencies, possibly two, because I've got friends around me who know a lot about it, and it'd be fun to chat with them about it. Hey, are you interested in cryptocurrency? You're welcome to donate cryptocurrency to GeekSpeak. Actually, I don't even know the wallet, but maybe I should put that up on the GeekSpeak website. If you do want to support the show, though, we do a Patreon, and you can learn more about that at geekspeak.org/support. And of course, this is GeekSpeak, and I'm Lyle, and that dude right there is Miles. But I just said that. So, Miles, did you hear about Amazon Go?
I have no idea what that is.
You have no idea what it is. Amazon Go is a 7-Eleven that is without staff.
Oh, that thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So supposedly this coming Monday, you'll see no checkout lines and no cashiers and just a store with like 7-Eleven stuff in it. You go in, you identify yourself, you pick things up and you leave, and it charges to your Amazon account. If you've gone to a hotel room, right, where there's like a bar inside, or like a fridge in the mm-hmm. hotel room, and there's snacks on top. Have mm-hmm. you seen the ones where there's actually sensors on them, and you can pick up like a candy bar, and a little sensor knows you picked it up and charges you?
I haven't.
Well, you're just not high enough, high class enough.
I tended to go like, I can pay $5 for that candy bar, or I could go downstairs and get one from the vending machine.
You know the obvious trick, right, is that you're there for 2 nights. You go and you eat. The first night you eat stuff, and the second night you go out and look for things to replace the bar with. They
do not serve. Oh, the mini bar, like you fill it up.
That's right.
You drink half the bottle and fill the rest with water.
So, of course, that kind of thing
Not
happens.
That I've ever done such a thing.
And you know, hotels actually also do this thing where, you know, no outside alcohol. Like, that's the rule kind of thing. they say that in the signature thing. You're like, yeah, that's going to happen. In any case, those little bar things are completely ridiculous. Because, of course, you bump into it and things get knocked over and they're going to charge you for it. No, that's ridiculous. So anyway, you can always fight those by just saying, no, I didn't buy anything. Unless, of course, you did. In any case, it feels like it's going to be that level of success. I mean, I'm sure it's going to be a little higher tech and all that, but come on.
Well, someone has actually tried using it. I did. I couldn't remember what the name of the store was, but I didn't
Amazon
remember
Go.
The story what it's talking about, where someone tried to shoplift, and they kind of got away with some yogurt, but it actually was really good at tracking what you picked up.
So the thing that's funny is, like, people that are good at, like, shoplifting or, close-at-hand magic, like, you know, sleight-of-hand stuff, that'll work for humans because you train to trick humans, and humans have those peripheral problems and stuff. But AIs that are doing that are going to have different ways of tricking them, right?
Right.
You could probably, like, take a wireframe of a milk carton and bring it in and just replace it. It might not know, right? Because the wireframe might perfectly... For us, we'd be like, that's weird. They've got a wireframe of a... You know what I mean? When I say a wireframe, like a stick drawing of the thing in three-dimensional space. In any case, I'm sure this thing will be highly successful. I'm excited to play with it and try it. And at the same time, is that really a problem we have? Is that like... we need that solution?
That's something that I find really interesting about the tech community at large, is they tend to find ways to exclude people from the mix. Like, when I go to the grocery store, I see a bunch of the same people, you know, working the cash register or stocking, and I say hi. Like, I recognize them, and they recognize me.
Part of your community.
Yes, exactly. But this is obviously made by people that are like, I don't like those people. I don't want to have anything to do with human contact.
My preferred environment is no one talks to me.
Like, the people that go, I can buy stuff on Amazon so I don't ever have to talk to anyone.
Yeah. Okay, so let's be really clear about what the store actually is. So it's like a convenience store with stuff on the shelves, right? The kind of stuff you'd buy maybe at a 7-Eleven or something, maybe higher class, I don't know, but stuff on shelves. And there are sensors on the shelves, and there's also a whole bunch of cameras in the store. And the general idea of it is you walk in, you pick up the things you want, you put them in your bag, and you walk out. And the entire time the system's tracking you such that you get charged for the things you bought. And you know, you get the receipt on your phone kind of thing. And the general idea of that's kind of cool because it stops the process of having to concern. Like, imagine you just run in real quick and grab something and leave. That would be kind of awesome. You're right, though, the community aspect and the not interacting with the people. But also, if the software at the front cashiers were just a little bit better. I mean, some of the stores I go to are pretty good cashier. You know, the cashiers are good at the gear, mm-hmm. and the tech they're using is pretty good. And, you know, you do something like the Apple Pay or some other service like that where you just kind of wave your device mm-hmm. in front of it. It's pretty nice.
And they still have human beings stocking the shelves. It's not...
Right. There's humans around in these things. Yeah.
But, yeah, this is definitely a store that Jeremy Bentham would be very proud of. He is the inventor of the Panopticon prison. The idea is that the prison was constructed in such a way as that you never know when you are being being viewed or watched, and so you always feel that you are being watched. It was actually very effective with regard to lowering the rates of recidivism. The drawbacks, of course, being that you psychologically tortured the people involved, and they were afraid to do any type of infraction to the point of a pathology.
Mm-hmm. Wait, I'm assuming there were severe punishments for infractions?
It wasn't so much that as the fact that you were always watched. They always saw what was happening.
When you were incarcerated or not?
Sorry?
Is this a prison? Like when you're incarcerated?
This is right? The model for a prison. I don't know if it actually went into effect. Okay. For example, the guard tower would have tinted glass, so the inmates would never even know if there was a guard there or not. When the guards went up and down into it, you couldn't see the ingress and egress.
Mm-hmm. See, it seems to me that that touches on this problem of that you see a lot in about the government watching us and such. That, like, if you've got nothing to hide, the argument, you know, you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to worry about. But the truth is that privacy is actually an important human factor, just like love and compassion and mm-hmm. all these other aspects of who we are. And so when you set up situations like that, it starts breaking down the general contract of society and yourself and other people. But why do you bring that up with regards to the store? Because when I go into a store, I assume I'm being watched all the time anyway. There's cameras everywhere.
Oh, there are now. I mean, there weren't when we were younger.
It's true.
This is a relatively recent change with regard to commerce.
I had this girlfriend at one point. I think we were like 18 or something. I remember being in college. Maybe I was even older. And she and I went into this grocery store, and she shoplifted. But the problem is I knew all the people in the grocery store. I've been there, going there all my life. Like, I knew people by name. And so we're being followed by Frank, and Frank's like following us around. I'm like, this is not – you know, I got really upset at her, of course. But the reason I might have been in the same mindset as her. I don't know. Young person trying to break the rules. Stealing candy bars or beer or whatever it was that she was stealing. I can't remember. But because of the community aspect and knowing these people, I had a better judgment about it because I cared about the people that worked there and who they were.
That and your reputation was at stake.
Yes. I would assume that your Amazon reputation would be at stake, right? All your reviews would go down in ratings.
The thing, though. For them, you know, picking something up, putting into your bag and walking out is a normal transaction. There is no difference there between a felonious behavior and the normal behavior.
True.
It does make me wonder, though, if it has the same effect as many of the tech companies that provide free food, where you just walk up. Some people, like, you flash your badge or whatever, you scan it. But most of the time, you, like, walk up, you pick something, and you take it. And then people will go right off the campus, and they'll go into some store, and they forget that that's not part of the routine. They go, and you pick up a muffin, and you walk out, and you're like, oh, wait, that was a Starbucks.
That doesn't happen, does it?
It has happened, yes.
Oh, that's really
funny. Not to me, but it has happened to others. And it has almost happened to me, where I went, wait. There's no place for me to flash my badge.
A really good friend of mine and a friend of the show, actually, one of our patrons, was visiting recently, and he's a elementary school teacher. He's been teaching elementary school for years. And we're at Netflix, and he's walking around with me, and I'm like showing him around. He's got his kids there, and he's like, oh, yeah, I guess there's like dispensers you can – I call it the torture machine because it's like the M&M dispenser. You can just spin the M&M thing and fill up your cup. And there's goldfish, and the kids are like the perfect age for goldfish. So he's like, can we get some goldfish? I'm like, yeah, you can get some goldfish. And so we're like kind of giving the kids goldfish. I mean, you can also have some food. He's like, oh, I don't want to take food. It was like a lunch line. So it was like, no, it's totally fine. You can come have some food. And it was like this idea that what I'm completely used to being fine with, you know, bringing a friend to work and having them eat with me, that's totally fine. But from a perspective of most worlds, that's not okay. You know, it wouldn't be appropriate for a small business that if they were serving food for people to bring along their friends and such to do that right. with, right? And it was of course also the comparison of public school system in California versus Netflix or, you know, any of these tech companies. The amount of wealth that exists in the tech companies compared to what's in the school system is kind of obscene. And so we joked about that at some level as well. It's hard. But I gave him as much goldfish as I possibly could.
it makes me think of the movie The Internship.
Yeah.
What if I take this one muffin? What if I take two? I'm going to take these other ones. Yeah, they're free. Go for it. Starts like grabbing the whole
can't big stuff.
Yeah. It's, I did have that feeling the first time I was confronted with it. This, wait. But if I take a bunch, it'll be kind of like stealing or just too much. It would be like this gluttony or
and also, isn't Google
avarice.
Also like you go to a counter and somebody makes you your coffee and such?
There are places you can do that, yeah.
Yeah. See, Google people make coffee for you. There's like staff there being experts and helping you. At Netflix, I make my own coffee. So like, that's the difference between – that's the difference in money scale.
Or you go someplace and, you know, they have these out trailers where you can go get a haircut. Just walk up and scan your badge and give you a haircut and you walk out.
Why do they scan the badge? Just make sure other people don't do it?
It depends. There's some places where you do scan your badge, or other places where
it's just expected. It's okay.
You just show up. Yeah. So it depends.
Is that why you look so frumpy? Because you don't work at Google anymore. So we don't got free haircuts. You can tell my hair is really long.
And by the way, I don't look frumpy. Quite distinguished. Thank you very much.
I would say distinguished. That's exactly the word I was going to use. It's the, yeah, you look distinguished. Deep stare into the eyes.
You'll never find.
You know, I'm going to have to do a photo of you today and make that the cover shot of the episode. If you're using a really awesome podcast player right now that actually shows chapter marks, there'll be a beautiful picture of Miles. Won't that be lovely?
Well, at least there'll be a picture of Miles.
The picture will be beautiful because I'll take it. The content. Meh. So tell me now that we've talked about the Amazon Go thing and free food in general. Okay, the etiquette at places like that. When you were at Google, bringing somebody, like you're bringing your family and having food with them, that was fine, right?
Yeah, in general, I never did just because I worked at Mountain View and my family was in Santa Cruz, so right. it never too came far, up. Right? But yeah, people brought their families there all the time.
Yeah, the general take that. The general translation of it, when you're not used to this kind of environment, the general translation is your time and energy is worth a lot to the company. And anything that's kind of distracting from the convenience of working and the flow of being productive, it makes more sense for the company just to provide that than for you to be distracted by making a hair appointment or whatever those things are. Mm-hmm. And I get that.
Or for that matter, just leaving the campus.
Yeah. Yeah, just leaving the campus in general. I mean, we used to not have like a catered service. We'd have some box lunch. We'd go out a lot. And when you go out with a group of people to lunch, you can burn a lot of time. If you just grab food, eat your desk sometimes because you're rushed, it's very convenient. I definitely would say that the general process is, you know, pays back. But there's also this aspect that if one company does it and another company doesn't do it, you're more likely to go to the company that does it. So I think there's some level of competition between the tech companies to provide good services to their employees.
Certainly. I don't know that I miss it, though.
Well, you're in downtown Santa Cruz. Downtown Santa Cruz is awesome.
Yeah, true.
I mean, that does benefit, right? Are you going out for food a lot there?
I am. I'm doing it more often than I should. I probably should take some food in so I'm not spending so much money for lunch, but yeah.
Okay, well, so that's the good side of these tech companies. The downside is that people in San Francisco don't seem to like these tech companies very much.
Well, some people don't. The tech buses have been an icon that has represented the gentrification of the area for quite some time now. There have been some people who've been upset with them. My own personal view has been very much every one of those buses is 50 cars that aren't on the road.
Right. Seems to be a benefit to the community at large to put people on buses.
Of all the things you're going to target, the buses seem like those shouldn't be the the focus. But at the same time, they're an easy target. They're visible.
Yeah. I remember when you were, there was a car, you know, people threw bottles and stuff at some of these vans a few years ago when you were working at Google. And I said, oh yeah, where's your bus stop in Scotts Valley? And you're like, oh, we're not supposed to talk about that. Like, there was a pretty clear idea of not to spread the word.
Yeah, it had been that way before those things happened. Mm-hmm. It was just, you don't want to tell people the routes just in general. But they're not public routes, and if someone doesn't need to know, why I tell them? Right. But things have escalated a bit.
Even if it was your friend asking you, though, you never did tell me.
I thought I did.
At night, I cried myself to sleep. Go on.
So things have escalated a bit. And some Apple buses were shot at what looked like rubber bullets, or what people believe to be rubber dummy bullets.
That's pretty scary.
Yeah, so broken windows broke the outer pane, but it didn't go all the way through. There was another one that had, you know, broken glass.
Has anybody gotten hurt?
No injuries.
Okay.
But Apple and Google both reported that they were rerouting some, changing the routes for the buses.
Probably randomizing as much as they can.
I don't know. Yeah. Or at least just,
it's interesting because it's like the buses, at least the buses that come into Santa Cruz, the Scotts Valley bus stop. Netflix has a very small bus that we get in, a little van. And then there's like four other buses that come through. And it's Facebook and Google and Apple. And then one of them has a second bus, I'm assuming, because I can't think of what other company it might be. But they all look the same. And one of the games I play, you know, they're either a gray bus or a white bus. They're indistinguishable. They have codes on the outside that kind of, as an employee, you'd probably know what that meant. But, you know, like my shuttle says Santa Cruz on it because that goes to Santa Cruz, right? So you look at it, and I always look at the people trying to figure out which one is this, you know. And if you get close enough, you can see their badges dangling, and you know it's Facebook or you know it's Google. But you can kind of tell from the employee. And I think
they changed it because, like, Facebook ones were always blue. The Google ones were almost always white. The Apple ones tend to be white as well.
Yeah, there's
the Yahoo were purple.
Yeah, there's no Yahoo buses anymore.
Yeah.
I'd assume. There is in Scotts Valley, there's the two white ones and a gray one. And I don't know. Anyway, though, and I sometimes, and I'll figure it out, but I've got to say that there is definitely a different style. If everybody looks like a little more put together, I assume it's the Apple bus. And then sometimes I'll come over and look at the badges.
If you see the inside of the buses, you know exactly which ones they belong.
Oh, really? Why?
Because, for example, the Google ones, they're all Google colors inside.
Oh, really?
The lining on the seats.
They're actually
the
owned by the companies.
Yes.
The other difference from Netflix, we got this little short bus. It's rented by some other firm services. You're not even our bus.
You're referring to yourself as being on the short bus.
It is fantastic to have a shuttle service. I mean, and I feel better about it because I'm not driving. Like, you know, when you and I would even go down to do the radio show in Santa Cruz, every once in a while, you and I both would drive down. We both live up in the valley and drive down. We'd end up at, you know, a place with multiple cars and feel horrible. So commuting together, you know.
Yeah, there are reasons why a company would want to have the private buses, even if there were better public transportation. Meaning, like, you get on the bus, you've got a built-in internet connection with a VPN.
Yep.
You know, it's assured that you're
also
can be safe with that.
You're also not. You don't have to think about anything else. You're on the bus, and when the bus stops, somebody will say, get off the bus, and you'll be at the destination. It's not like you transfer or anything like that. So.
Right. But I do feel some of that resentment that people say about why isn't public transit better. And many people have said, like, well, why don't those companies make it better? And I think they, in some respects, overestimate how much power the individual companies have to do so. Like, some people might refer to Mountain View as being a company town for Google, but it doesn't extend far beyond there.
Mm-hmm. And so you're saying the argument is like, well, these tech companies are spending all this money on their private bus system, but they could just put that into infrastructure for public transportation,
right,
making life better for everybody.
Right. If memory serves, Google doesn't spend the same amount of money on transit in many other countries because even many other countries have a mass transit system. Like, you know, in Manhattan, they don't spend the same money on their...
Right, you don't need to.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's true.
And it's a shame that we're letting our infrastructure wallow like that, that we still have very much this, you know, public transit is the thing you just... You know, it's an afterthought. Mm-hmm. It's... You know, oh, it's good enough, whatever. And it's a shame that there wasn't a universal Wi-Fi whenever you get onto a Caltrain. us, or like why BART is so unreliable, or
is BART unreliable?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's a bummer.
And so, I mean, when you compare it to, you know,
BART, by the way, is Bay Area Transportation System.
It's
the
Bay system. Area Rapid Transit.
Oh, excuse me. But it's not rapid.
Well, I mean, compared to, you know, compared to walking, it is.
The Silicon Valley transportation system, which nobody really uses.
Well, that's the thing, though.
Unless you're going to the city.
That's the thing. There is no Silicon Valley transit system. There's all sorts of, like, there's the VTA buses.
Yep.
But then if you go over to the East Bay, it's AC Transit.
Weren't you trying to commute via bus years ago before you worked at Google?
Yep.
And it was took you 2.5 hours?
Yeah, something like that.
Did you actually keep that up? You are a stubborn bastard.
Well, it was also due to... when I was driving, I was my wife was very fearful of my safety driving on the roads constantly, especially because I took the back roads. So it was the easiest way to avoid the major traffic of 85 and 280 that I'd take Highway 9 and Skyline. And, you know, it would rain and it would get wet. And sure enough, I did crash my truck into the side of the road. Luckily, it was the cliffside or the hillside rather than the cliffside.
Or you'd be dead.
Right. But at the same time, like, the reason I did that was because driving is dangerous.
Yeah.
The reason why you want to have public transit is because driving is dangerous. And yet our solutions for it tend to be like, oh, we're going to have self-driving cars.
Well, it's less dangerous.
Except you have things like, yeah, and then we're going to have self-driving buses. But why not just have a bus? Is really your limiting factor the fact that you have a driver there? Like...
I'm Lyle Troxell, and I'm talking with Miles Elam. We're talking about the news of the week. If you're enjoying our program, please feel free to learn more about our program in every episode of GeekSpeak for years and years at geekspeak.org. And of course, you can learn to support our program at geekspeak.org/support. Miles, tell me about highly unique YouTube videos that should definitely be copyrighted, absolutely positively, because they're unique.
So a gentleman by the name of Sebastian Tomczak. He's a professor, a music technologist, is a self-described music technologist, who has a hobby. He uploads random experiments, if you will, to YouTube. Now, one of the things they uploaded was 10 hours long, and someone lodged a copyright complaint. 5 copyright complaints actually came by.
To this video of his.
To this video of his. And so the question
was he,
is...
Was he playing someone's music?
Well, he was playing something that was very familiar.
Oh.
And so you wonder, is that crossing a line? Well, what he was actually playing was 10 hours of white noise. You know, the snow you get like, yes. from old TVs before they had the blue screen.
The background universe radiation noise?
Exactly. He had some software generate
do you think there's prior,
white noise.
Do you think there's prior art on that?
Some folks felt that it matched up to something they had, and so they lodged a complaint. And some of them were making money off of his work. They were able
what?
Because with copyright claims, you can choose to put your own ads onto someone else's work if it infringes on you rather than just taking it down.
So that's the choice when you're saying infringement. I'm going to pull revenue from them or I'm going to have it be taken down. Why do some people have the right to be able to do that? Why couldn't he pull that claim on somebody else? Like who owns the right to be able to say,
well, yeah, as far as he was concerned, no one did. He was just uploading
white noise. No, but there's some power users on YouTube that can say, that's an infringement of my stuff. How do you get to
be
one of those
people? I own that random pattern.
Yeah. That's the other thing. It's like it might sound like that, but it's not yours because it's random.
That's the antithesis of copyright. Copyright is there's a specific thing that you're copying. Random noise. It's in the definition not copying anything.
I just also love the idea of prior art. That's the noise of the universe being born. You can't get prior art than that. So I'm assuming that stopped and he got, but should he make money off of that? I mean,
Well, if you upload it, then sure, you could put an ad on that. But I don't know how many people are going to be like, yeah, I want to watch 10 hours of white noise.
Hey, you know, if I was testing sound and environment, I would want, you know, if I wanted a white noise simulation or pink noise simulation, that's probably what I'd use as a YouTube video. That's lovely. 5 hours. You know,
but I want this really to show there's, to go there's to court. Some, yeah.
I want a court case with like a jury listening to noise. What were you going to say? Sorry.
No, I'm done.
I've been done a while. All right, let's talk about a story we've passed on for a while, but it's time to talk about Spectre and Meltdown. And I don't know if we need to fully get into it, but let's go ahead and give a little bit of the definition.
Both of them refer to vulnerabilities within the CPU itself. So not on the operating system or software running there, but actually the physical hardware has something that can be used to compromise security is what it comes down to. That one process can be doing something, and because it's a speed optimization, send a series of instructions down. And because the kernel can switch contexts, some of that data can still be in CPU registers when the next process comes around and could potentially read that.
I mean, the important part of this that to think about is that programs on a system run different levels of writes. And it's really important for those writes to be segregated out such that a machine can be running some protected space and also have other spaces that aren't accessible. And that separation allows things like your browser and the code that's running in that not to know what something else on your computer is, because there's actually two different programs running this separation. And it gets really important in places like AWS or other scales where you're renting a server, a virtual server, and that virtual server is actually running on a on hardware with lots of other virtual servers. And those are all separated out by software, which is highly complicated, but in general is two pieces of code running on the same machine looking like two different computers. And this kind of problem is the way that is why that works.
Right. It's a data leakage problem.
Yeah.
And it's not the first one. I mean, CPUs have bugs. I mean, hardware has bugs just like software does. In fact, in some respects, the ROM or some of the software on a chip is basically it's software that has been burned in,
right,
so that it can't be changed.
If you've ever upgraded a BIOS to something, the BIOS is kind of the base level operating system of the chip, and it's like a hardware level OS, if you will. That's what you're talking about burning in.
Yeah,
but let's not get into details. Right. You know, the thing about this conversation is so fun is that you and I could probably do like a 4-hour conversation on how this is happening and really get into it, but at the same level, I want to talk at a higher level so that not everybody's bored out of their minds listening to us.
Right. I was about to say, like, we could describe it and we'd be bored while we were doing it, let alone
I find it kind of fascinating. But anyway, why are we bringing it up now after it's been talked about quite a bit in the news and everything?
All right. And just to be clear, this is not the end of the world. You know, the sky is not falling. Going to deal with it.
Of course, every computer you have is vulnerable to this, and you can't upgrade it and make it unvulnerable without making the machine worse.
Well, that's the thing.
There is that aspect. There is something wrong with it, but
it depends. If you have an AMD CPU or an Intel CPU.
Yeah, but
the Intel CPUs. Yeah. The Intel CPUs, they're actually the only way to make the fix is to make it slower. Effectively, you cut out the speed optimization, and so you end up being, you know, 5 to 20% slower.
Right.
And which is a non-trivial hit, you know, and it depends upon, you know, the types of workloads and all sorts of minutiae.
And it's been essential to do this. Like, so modifying the operating system such that we got rid of these vulnerabilities was essential, especially for large hosts like AWS, like Amazon's services. So any large virtual hosting system had to do this. And this basically effectively makes all of their systems less capable.
Right. I mean, makes them more expensive, too.
Makes them more expensive. Right.
But the thing here is that there are a lot of other side effects, such as industrial systems that were SEAL systems are single purpose. You know, they were written with software all in a package to say, okay, we need this level of CPU to be able to get this project done. And, you know,
everything's been architected right. with the idea that this wasn't a problem. Now this is a problem, and all of a sudden the architecture is broken.
Yeah, you take away 15% of the CPU time, and suddenly the software may not work.
Right. But at the same time, I mean, if you're in an isolated environment, is it important that this vulnerability gets fixed?
It depends upon what you're working on. It's hard to say.
If you have physical security of this computer system, let's say it's running some automation process in a big industrial environment, and it's not networked, is it really even a problem?
That's a judgment call.
Yeah.
It really does. Whenever anyone tries to figure out, you know, their threat profile.
Right.
You know, that's the judgment call you have to make. If you are a home user, yeah, you're going to be vulnerable because you're connecting to the internet. At the same time, like phones, chances are that most mobile phones are not going to get updated.
Right. You want the performance to stay high. You don't want to have any kind of performance degradation because that means battery degradation, which is everybody's matters about. But also, the software that's going on is pretty controlled.
Yeah, they're also single user devices.
Yeah. So, and this is the other thing about this vulnerability that's important to understand. You have to get code to run on the phone on the CPU anyway. You can't just it's not a remote access mm-hmm. vulnerability.
And it helps on the implementation. Yeah, and it helps to know what other software is running that you're trying to grab data from, which is why it's a problem for hosting providers like Amazon, AWS. But it's really not that dire, at least in my opinion.
It's not like the OpenSSL cert problems we had years ago, that was a disaster comparatively. But what are people thinking about? Like, so solutions came about, Intel's helped, Google kind of first announced this, has been fixes and patches, and everybody's kind of the service community has been kind of solving this problem by modifying the operating system in some hacky way.
Well, there's been fits and starts. Like Intel has released firmware updates, but they haven't been that great of quality. A lot of people have said, like, no, this is bad. They've rolled it back. They're looking for something better. AMD has been trying to distance themselves, saying, yes, we're vulnerable to Spectre, but our fix doesn't actually slow down our CPU. We don't have the same architecture as Intel, which is valid.
Mm-hmm.
And Intel, for their part, like they've been making patches to Linux to mitigate Heartbleed. Or, sorry, not Heartbleed, Meltdown.
Who has been making?
Intel.
Intel has offered changes to Linux. So, first off,
Intel is one of the major corporate contributors to the Linux kernel.
Right. So the Linux kernel, which, of course, is an open source operating system, which is pretty much running most servers in the world now, it is developed a lot in large part by individual corporations that invest in it because they use it.
Mm-hmm.
So any company that's doing a lot of development on
every systems, Android phone,
yeah, there's a lot of use for it. So Google invested in it heavily, Intel's investing in it heavily, Facebook's investing in it heavily, everybody does it. So Intel's produced some patches to the Linux kernel so that their processors wouldn't have as much problems with these vulnerabilities. What does Linus Torvalds think about this?
Well, actually, to back up, they're actually Intel got caught just making a patch that fit their CPU, and then it also slowed down AMD's, and AMD was like, point of order, and they submitted a patch that did an else statement, like, else, right, if course. Not Intel.
When you compile the operating system, you can target the CPU you're compiling for. In fact, you have to. So when you write the code, you can actually make conditionals to say, compile it this way for one operating system, or one processor, and compile it a different way for a different processor. That's a standard thing to do. So that's funny that Intel did that without thinking about AMD. How selfish.
And at the same time, there have been people saying, like, hey, they're trying to fix it. And here in the Linux kernel mailing list, they were talking about if the alternative was a 2-decade product recall and giving everyone free CPUs, I'm not sure it's entirely insane to try to get, you know, a quick fix in there. Linus Torvalds wasn't having it, and he's usually quite outspoken. And
this is the person that first wrote Linux.
Yes, and he's still the benevolent dictator. He's the guy.
He's not benevolent. He's a complete jerk. I mean, right. Chris. I mean, I respect the heck out of him. I use Git every day, and he's amazing, dude. And he's a jerk. So go on.
Yes.
Oh, and he acknowledges he's a jerk,
which doesn't really make it better. But you know, whatever.
Of course.
And so he comes back and says, you seem to have bought into the Kool-Aid. Please add a healthy dose of critical thinking. You know, just tears into the person. And I don't know that I really want to read.
You don't have to read it all, but stuff. The general gist.
Although I can criticize him because he's misspelled Kool-Aid.
Nice. Do you think that he's upset because there's a clear hardware vulnerability, and this fix that everybody has for now is to make the operating system worse? I mean, that's kind of insulting, right?
Well, I think one of the things that Linus Torvalds and others have is a legitimate concern, which is that these fixes many times are not complete. They're not solving the problem.
They're a mitigation at some level.
They're a quick hack, and in many ways, they end up either introducing new vulnerabilities, mm-hmm. Making the system less stable.
So on January 7th or 8th, this came out on the 3rd, I think, that this really hit the fan. And I was running into security experts, you know, that are trying to mitigate this problem. And they're like, it was a frantic state for the first week, right? It was like, how quick can we make this not as bad as it possibly can be?
Right. And so there was, and it wasn't clear how bad it was.
There was a lot of questions still needing to be answered. Yeah. People were answering. There were some early assessments that were incorrect. And in general, just trying to get some patch to solve some of the problems was essential. So I can imagine it went very quickly at first. And it's so easy. It is so easy to criticize software. You know, it's hard to write and it's really easy to criticize. And that's just the nature of the complexity. So did Linus have solutions? Did he help with the problem, or did he just sit back and go, "You guys drank the Kool-Aid"?
Well, no, he actually believes that there is a line of thinking in these patches that Intel could do to be able to do a real fix. And his criticism was that Intel was not going down that path, that they were doing something that was more marketing-driven rather than a real fix, because the real fix, by necessity, is going to hobble performance tremendously for not only their current CPUs, but CPUs going back a whole decade.
So one of the things, and I remember talking about this early on in GeekSpeak era, because we used to talk a lot about processors, one of the things that was a breakthrough and on speed and performance was having a processor have multiple execution paths. And in those execution paths, you can actually, before you know what you need to execute, you can predictively execute a few things at once. And what that benefit gives you is that by the time you decide what to execute, you have already executed it. So it's predictive execution of code. And that whole piece has a vulnerability thing with this problem. So one of the solutions is, well, don't just disable that feature. Like, don't use that anymore. But of course, that is a, you know, some percentage boost of the processor. And there's no way to prove it without that. Now, of course, they'll be able to change hardware over time. They'll be able to redesign. 4 or 5 years from now, we'll see processors that will not have these vulnerabilities, but will still be able to do predictive execution. This is just one piece, by the way, of this.
Earlier than that. I mean, they're going...
Well, okay, so they're going to do it fast, but... It at least a year out, because you set up fabs. You know,
I'm just thinking not 4 years. That seems excessive.
Well, this thing is, I'm doing it excessive because I know that their timelines are definitely extended longer than you'd expect. But maybe it's only a year out. Hopefully they'll be able to, you know, create the processors that won't have this kind of problem. But of course, all that is a lot of development time and a lot of solutions in the future. And the solution right there for that predictive is just turn off predictive execution of code paths. You won't have this leakage potential because they won't have pre-predicted, and therefore you won't be able to sniff out what the pre-prediction was for a path that wasn't executed. And that solves one of these problems. So I'm assuming that's the kind of thing that he's arguing. And I think that the slowdown makes sense if you want to have a hardened system.
Yeah. The arguments he makes later on, as abusive as he is about it, at the same time, when I say abusive, it's... I believe that he is in good faith believing that the person who is engaging him is being somewhat disingenuous. But at the same time, it's quite caustic. So on the one hand, quite caustic. On the other hand, he makes some really good points with regard to the quality of the patch that are going through and the tendencies, the directions that he's seeing it go in.
Yeah.
So, and that is his job as the gatekeeper. You know, wish he wasn't quite so
jerky about it.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure that leader in that community being that way causes that community to be difficult to enter if you're not that way. Right? Like, it clearly is a way of acting that produces people around you that are going to be okay with that way of acting. Yeah. It's very exclusionary.
Linus Torvalds is not a cartoon character or a fictional character, so he's not exactly like, say, a Dr. House, you know,
yeah,
you know, fictional character. He does have a bit more empathy than that. But,
yeah, but
at the
Dr. House got great work out of people. Come on, he saved
lives.
But
at the same time, there is this weird notion that if someone is good at their job, they're allowed to be abusive.
Right. That's not tolerable in most, I mean, yeah.
It's tolerable in a lot of industries, and it's something that we...
It shouldn't be.
Yeah.
You need to learn to work with people. It's so important to work with people. Now, at the same, it's so challenging with someone like Linus because, you know, producing an operating system is amazing in itself, and he achieved that at a young age and has built an industry around open source software and people having a free operating system, and the driving force behind it is making a great operating system, not making a sellable operating system, not making it, you know, marketing driven. It is about making really good code, and there's something very noble and beautiful about that. And if it was just that, it'd be impressive. But then he also thought, you know, source control and source management, this is like, you know, having collaborative people work on projects together with source code is really crappy. I don't like this. Let me reinvent a way of doing that. And he produced a system, Git. He wrote that by scratch as a side project at some level, which is now a fundamental standard of software sharing. Like, I use Git every day, and
he got the idea from somewhere else, but yeah.
That's true. Do you want to give the credit of the service? I can't remember the other...
BitKeeper was the original commercial software that
distributed,
did it.
Distributed.
He also got ideas from Mercurial, which existed prior to
Git. I mean, when Git was first getting kind of popular, you took a look at the source code and stuff, and I asked you about it, and you're like, yeah, there's other people that are much smarter than me.
No, it wasn't so much I looked at the source code. I was looking at the description, like the diagrams and the organization of it, and was realizing with regard to version control, if I had been sitting and just like working on that project for a long time, I would not have come up with that solution.
What solution specifically are you thinking about?
The acyclic graph that he had, the implementation that he had made, along with signatures, like
an acyclic graph? Is that what you just said?
Yeah. It sounds fancier than it is. It's a series of nodes where each one is pointing to the next one, and
like a link
they're
list.
Always pointing. Yeah, that's an example. Okay. That points always in the same direction. In other words, there's no loop.
Mm-hmm.
No cycle, acyclic.
Okay.
Which is what you have. You have things going further and further back in time.
Yeah.
But if I were to make a version control software, or at least
before thinking of this, yes.
Yes. I would have made something that looked like Subversion. And I remember Linus Torvalds talking about Subversion, how little he thought of it. And then...
in his very pleasant nature.
Yes. Yeah, I believe the words you were saying, the quote that he used was, you can disagree with me and you can think that Subversion is good and you would be ugly and stupid.
Not wrong, but ugly and stupid.
Right.
What a sweetheart.
Right.
Total sweetheart.
But, I mean, Linus Torvalds is, I'm trying to think of a good way to describe this. I don't believe that I will be ever as good a programmer as Linus Torvalds was 20 years ago.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And he is better than what he was 20 years ago.
Right.
There are a few programmers out there where I'm just like, I got nothing.
You know,
John Carmack's another one.
Yeah.
In a different field. He's in gaming, but yeah.
But you know how to be polite to people. So there is that.
Depends on who you ask, but yeah.
Now your pedanticism has decreased and your compassion has increased in the 20 years. So there you go. You've got to be a better human being. He's become a better programmer. It's a good trade. Okay, we got one more story for today, and that is just totally, totally unbelievable. Tell me about Australian birds of prey.
Yes, raptors. We covered a while back a story of crows or ravens.
Crows. I can't remember if it was a raven or a crow. And I'll tell this one then. It was basically there was an area where there were nuts, and it was a hard-to-crack nut. And the the bird would grab these nuts and drop them into the street, and cars would run over them with their tires, and then the birds would go eat them. So it was basically an easy way for them to open these nuts. But then over time, that happened for a while, and then over time, they started dropping all the nuts on the crosswalks. And the reason for that, of course, is that the crosswalks had an intersection. So the birds would drop the nuts where the cars would go. The cars would go. The crow or bird would wait at the intersection until the light changed, stopping flow of traffic. They'd go out and eat. When the light changed again, they'd move away. And this way, they wouldn't get killed accidentally by a car speeding through. Mm-hmm. So in a relatively short period of time, the crows were able to use the cars as a form of technology for themselves.
Right. And there's another story I remember seeing where owls were swooping down this dark highway because the headlights of the cars were coming by and illuminating rodents in the brush nearby. So they would swoop right in front of the cars.
And use that light to help them out.
Yeah, grab the rodent and head off. And they were always doing it just right. Maybe it wasn't owls. There was another type. They had just the right size of wing to do this. And if a car was speeding, it hit the bird because they got the timing off.
Oh, interesting.
Because the cars were going at approximately the same speed, they were able to work it out. Now, why are we bringing this up? Bring this up because in Australia, you have a lot of dry, arid area, and you get grass fires on a semi-regular basis. What they found were birds like black kites, whistling kites, brown falcons.
These are all raptor birds, right?
Yes, were waiting by the edges of these brush fires, looking for small rodents, small mammals, to run away from the fire and would swoop up and catch them.
Totally makes sense.
You can even imagine
that birds of prey like that, once it started happening, if they saw smoke in the distance, they might go to the fire because good source of food, sure.
What ornithologists hadn't seen before was the fact that some of these birds were taking smoldering embers, grabbing him, flying off to some other location, and setting fires.
No.
So that when the fire started up, then they got the exodus and they grabbed a meal.
Okay, so this is interesting. In the example of the birds using the headlights of the cars, or the birds using the tires and the streetlights, mm-hmm. those are all obviously new invention, like new behaviors for the birds to take because those things didn't exist 150 years ago. But forest fires have existed for a long time. These birds been doing this for a long time? Do they know?
Apparently, Australian Aboriginal lore has a lot of references to it happening.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But,
okay. You know. Well, then that's probably true. I mean,
yeah, I was about to say, but, you know, white people show up and they're like, whatever, stories. So it isn't until later that
I love that Sutter's like, we've discovered some Aboriginal tribes. Like, no, you didn't.
Yeah, we got the art from thousands of years ago.
You see the bird with the fire stick? Yeah, that's what was going on. Wow, that's amazing.
So this marks
humans aren't that special.
Yeah, this is the first recorded instance of fire being used by an animal other than humans. For the longest time, most people other than Aboriginal Australians have considered human beings to be the only species on the planet that
uses fire. Well, except, of course, plant life. A lot of plant life uses fire, but animal life.
Plant life's fairly passive in its use of fire, isn't it?
Well, in the sense that it gets used by fire. I mean, the whole forest exists because of fire. Like, it's part of their reproduction system. So
right. And the same could be said of animals. When you have, the birds watching at the end of a fire for anything that's flushed out, it's the, I'm going to take this fire and I'm going to set something alight with it.
It sounds very human to me.
Burn it all.
Burn it all.
I want some grub.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence. He's used with permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. You can use our stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know that we made it. Today's episode is named by Greg Merkley up in Canada. Amazon goes with buses after meltdown. Amazon goes with buses after meltdown. Thank you, Greg. And the theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. My name is Lyle Troxell. You can learn more about this program or any of our programs up at geekspeak.org, and you can even support our program by going to geekspeak.org/support and join our Patreon and give us a buck a month or something. And today I want to thank Miles Eel, thank you very much for being here.
Always a pleasure.
Any coding lately?
Yes, I'm very, very late to the party in terms of Docker.
Like 2 years ago, I was like, we should make a Docker instance for the GeekSpeak site. It'd be so easy for us to develop and share.
Well, you did that a year ago, but yeah.
No, it was like 2 years ago. I know this, I know the commit that I was dealing with.
Okay.
Anyway, though, why the change of heart? Like, just explain what Docker is, what containers are.
That's the thing, though. The explanation that was given to me wasn't compelling. I was thinking about all the technical challenges having to
I would have liked it, Lyle, but you couldn't talk about it.
No, I don't know that I could have. Really, what did it for me was, okay, I went through a tutorial, and it was, one, I was able to launch, you know, a Debian instance. It's like, oh, that spawned much faster than if I did a full install. And but I'm like, well, there are other ways of doing it. I could have done, like, a kickstart, you know, for Debian install. And really, I think the part that might have been missing for me is the fact that Alpine Linux exists. It used to be the default one used to be BusyBox Linux, but a full Linux distribution in less than 5 megs. And so that's the sole purpose is just get an environment up and running and have that one piece of software or one command that you want to have run. And suddenly it made a lot more sense because I was always seeing like a full Ubuntu or Debian or Red Hat Linux installation with all of them. I just couldn't see the benefit of it, even if it was faster than making a virtual machine.
So to be clear,
an old habits die hard.
What a Docker or a container image structure is, a file format which is actually kind of an operating system contained that you then also install other things on top of. And then I can kind of name that container and I can say, hey, Miles, run this container. And Miles gets a copy of my container, but my container is built off a container he already has, so like a base operating system. So what he actually gets from me is a very light load, which is just the stuff on top. When he runs it, he runs the same image and everything the same as mine. So him running it on his system and my running it on my system produces the same virtual operating system at the same time.
Yeah, it's using a technology called UnionFS, which is you have your base one, then it's kind of like it's like the image that comes into my mind is Fantasia, the last scenes where they have the different cells layered on top of each other to give a sense of depth.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of how I think of UnionFS.
File system, of course, what SFS stands for. But the general idea is that if I have an operating system and then I want to modify it, instead of getting a full copy of it again with a modified version, I just produce the diff of what would modify it. And then when you do that and you load the operating system, it looks like it's the new operating system, even though it's composite of multiple operating or multiple different diffs.
Right. And I had wondered about how do you keep that straight? Because you were talking about, like, oh, you make a snapshot of that and you build on top of that. And I was thinking, God, that's because I'd done similar things, like playing around with UnionFS years ago.
We used to run the GeekSpeak website off of images like this, sparse images.
Oh, okay. That I was wondering, like, doesn't this get old, and how do you get back to a clean setup, and how do you do updates, and then everything seemed like it was getting heavyweight to me. And I just didn't see the build process because I wasn't doing it. I wasn't involved. I didn't see the Docker build. You have your new base and you're copying just the files that you have in your build process on top of that each time. And that's how you make your new image. It's not that you are taking your old image and doing everything on top of the thing
and
over and over.
The nice
again.
Thing about like a Docker image, that file format, it's an open source file format, though there's also a business around it. If a virtual host says, we run Docker images, you can use them. So you can switch around your hosts really easily without using a proprietary operating system, which is kind of nice.
Right. But now it's not just Docker. You have everyone is using – you can use a Docker image. You can use a Docker image with DigitalOcean. You can use a Docker image with Amazon's AWS infrastructure, which is where I'm learning to do it with.
The one part that I've been having trouble with, and the reason I kind of stopped, is mostly because my partner on the site didn't want anything to do with it. Oh, that was you. And the other part was the other thing was the data layer, right? Because it's great when you have an instance you can spin up and just run code, but you do need data storage someplace and logs and all of that. And so when you're dealing with a total destructive image, because that's the benefit, is it that you can just spin them up and destroy them and spin them up and destroy them and not think much about it. Your data layer has to be consistent and persistent. And so that's the one issue, is that you've got to have a you have a couple containers. One's a long live container or write space that's long live. Have you done Docker with Postgres?
Or you have it share, like the host operating system has a directory that gets shared with the instance, and that looks down.
And have you seen that run with like Postgres?
Yeah.
Have you got that running yet?
No.
So when are we moving over? Because, of course, once you have an ability to
run... Yeah, we got day jobs.
Once you've got an ability to run a simple command and have the full stack of what you're running, you can have more people contribute to your project.
Right.
So it's much easier. Like, when we need to make a change to the GeekSpeak website, it's me that has to do it. Because no one else actually runs the system on their system, because you've got to get a certain version of Ruby. And we just stop right there. Because what a pain. anything else? Are you doing Docker for work or for pleasure? Work is pleasure. I'm an engineer. I love it.
I am doing it for work, although I found myself playing around with stuff with GeekSpeak just because it was like, hey, if I can make a mistake, it's not going to get me fired.
Great.
If I waste time and like I don't get anywhere, then no harm done. If I get somewhere, then hey, then I have something I can put up on a DigitalOcean.